Musette then goes through this training process where she is taught how to be a proper woman. There's a lot of complications with the scene coming up, so I'll just say how I felt about it, and then I'll let you two talk. Where Musette breaks down because she cannot deal with the pressures of being what they expect a proper society woman to be. And for me, that was probably one of the most affecting moments of the whole movie. I guess you could say it's very hackneyed and melodramatic, but I still felt like in an animated movie at that time for that caliber, that was a level of drama that was very, very strange, and it felt realer than what you're going to get from other animated films at the time like that. And I thought that was a very raw moment, especially coming from a female screenwriter. Would you two like to put in?
Oh yeah, it could also just be a reflection on women in that time period as well, and just living up to stereotypical norms. And so seeing that reflect in the movie was interesting, because I mean, like, we're not really there anymore. I say that very lightly, but it was, I agree, it was raw, and it was interesting to see that. It was also just interesting to see Musette just like adopt this like characteristic of what like a Parisian woman is so immediately, which goes like that feeds into like how naive she is, which is pointed out in the next scene, the horsey scene, but we'll get to that then.
Yeah, yes. I agree, but I think that it, for me, it's a little bit deeper. You know, here you have this cat who, based off, like I said, a 2-minute conversation, had all these beliefs that she doesn't belong in the countryside. She's too good. She needs to be in Paris. She gets there and she's all gung-ho for this transformation. And now it's almost like a reality check that it's hard. It's not necessarily who you are, but who you could be with the work. But it's, on one hand, it's so melodramatic, you know, like this whole, you know, like a toddler where everything is to the extreme. I can't do it. I can't do it, blah, blah, blah. But on the other hand, it's almost like a reality check for her where she's realizing that she may not be who she thinks she should be, yeah. If that makes sense.
Like everything she romanticized about, like,
right,
being in Paris and being a woman in Paris and what that's like, kind of just came to like a halt when she saw that she couldn't just perform. And I think you're right about that, in the sense that maybe she thought it would just be easy, that it would come to her, maybe because she thought that she was best fit for it in that
moment. She was so willing to throw her friends away because this is where she thought she belonged, and now it's hard.
Yeah. Thank you. Oh, wow. That really helps my perspective too, because I wasn't thinking of it like that, in that way. I'm really taken aback just thinking about that even now. When I went through it, like, I knew it was melodramatic, but it was affecting me in an emotional way that I couldn't quite place. And now that helps. Wow, thank you.
Brittany and I have psych degrees, so we can dissect the psyche of cartoon cats, apparently.
Yeah. That's what degrees for, you know, the little concentration, those cartoon cats.
Cartoon cats.
Maybe I should get a psych degree. I'd quit spending so much goddamn time with them.
Yeah, you know, you could join the club with us. Put them to some use.
The Cartoon Kitty Cat Club?
Yeah, psych degrees. Gotta use them for something.
Yeah, something, all right. after she has this little breakdown and she says she's about to, like, give up and go back to the country, Maurice takes her aside and he does this grooming process, initiation process with her, where he, like, shows her all the big sights, all the things he can provide her, in the big city, and what he's doing here is like building her trust up and like wowing her. Yeah. Like it's not.
You really said it with the word grooming, like that just really hit the nail on the head with what that whole scene was. You said it, and I was like, oof, mm-hmm. So true.
This shit all took me aback. And when I think about, like, Chuck Jones's work, I mean, this is the guy who really helped bring us, like, Pepe Le Pew, like, a French womanizer, to say right. the least, about who Pepe Le Pew obviously is. and I just felt like, man, what kind of guys was Chuck Jones around? Was Chuck Jones this kind of guy at one time? Like, I don't know. Something about Chuck Jones. I just feel like there's always something a little like snooty, skeezy about him. You know what I'm saying?
I never gave it that much thought, but I can see exactly where you're coming from.
Thank you.
I don't disagree. So.
Yeah. And that's not even a reflection on his work as an animator. I just think there's a lot of pieces there that can be connected. Yeah, I'm not a perfect guy myself. I like the Ralph Bakshi a little too much at times. It's okay.
But grooming like a little Fritz action.
But grooming is not okay, and he shouldn't be doing it. And at one point, she says something to him, like, and he's like, oh, now that wouldn't be proper of me. And I was like, yes, you were right the first time, Maurice. That would not be proper of you. None of this has been proper of you. You don't know, like, the first right. thing about you not being proper in this situation. I hate you, Maurice.
So I have a question, actually.
Yeah, please.
So in this scene, and I may be foreshadowing a little bit for like things that happen later, or just like talking about things that actually happen later in the film, but I just want to make a connection.
It's a 50-year-old film. Don't worry about it.
In this scene, he could have easily just drugged her with champagne, like we see later. Like, why?
I think the answer is because he wanted her to finish her training.
But, like, he saw that she wasn't good at it. Like, he seems like a very, like, let's get things going kind of cat, you know? So.
Yeah, but I think the answer is exactly what he said. He's grooming her. Yeah. And so he needs her to finish her training. Otherwise, he can't sell her. And if he drugs her, that's it. That's the end. There's no coming back from that.
He is complicitly aware of how naive she is.
Yeah.
Like, he sees it in, like, the first moment they talked, her, like, whole response was, well, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a big cat in Paris. I'm going to be doing this. I'm from the country. And he's just like, there's a target if there ever right. was one. Like, yeah. they make that very obvious. And I think it's a credit to, like, Chuck Jones as a character writer that he makes it so obvious on a certain level. Like, this is almost like a way of teaching your kid to not trust French hipsters or something like that.
or just strangers in general.
Yeah, strangers in general.
On the train.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you see how gullible Musette is, children. Do not be like her. Though that's a little sexist on his part too. He this film, I feel like Dorothy and Chuck are both kind of engaging in like some sexist downplaying that's a little mean-spirited at times in this film. Do either one of you agree? You're welcome to disagree with me. It's okay. I won't ban you from the show or nothing. Don't worry.
Oh, no. I'm completely agreeing with your statement, but that's also a reflection on the majority of society at that time.
True.
Yeah.
So as disgusting as it is to look at it now, we need to put ourselves in the shoes of, oh, people could have been frustrated with that back then, but nobody really spoke out. So it was normalized.
Some of the things like they say at the time, like, it just kind of feels like them almost being a little blunt and edgy in a manner. Like, you know, like they're being harsh in a way cartoons wouldn't be harsh at that time. So that's how I'm kind of writing off a little bit of it in my head. You know?
What do you mean harsh?
Like there are certain body comments that are made towards Musette, and then there are comments that Musette makes about other people that she doesn't want to be around that I feel are, like, intense in a way they wouldn't let cartoon characters be, you know what I'm saying?
Okay.
We can talk about it a little later when we get towards the end.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, like, even talking about her and how it wasn't sexy enough earlier.
Yeah, and that, like, kind of leads us into her coming back to the big, coming back and doing more training. And then we see her, like, as this newly invented debutante. Her hair has been colored. And this is where we get the boner joke. They had the audacity to put in a boner joke where the Maurice sees her for the first time in her new and improved debutante figure. And he just, like, swings forward a little bit, and then his whole body stiffens up, and it, like, takes on this angular position, and his tail is, like, completely stretched out straight, and it is such an obvious boner joke, and he even apologizes for his manner as if he's, like, just immediately, like, struck a boner in front of her. I could not believe, like, how implicit they were making the gag for what's supposed to be a major children's animated movie with a Golden Books tie-in.
I never knew that there was a Golden Books. I had no idea until you said it at the beginning of the show.
You should find it. I bet it doesn't have a boner joke. It would be cleaner to introduce to your kids.
Oh my god. Okay, wait, hold on. We gotta pause for a second. I am going to be a third grade teacher in September. So I've been collecting books from my library. You're saying golden books?
Yeah, little golden books. You know what those are.
Okay, so I had them. I have them in the back of my car right now. Oh, I have like a stack like this in the back of my car, and I have a bunch in my garage that I was going to donate to like this aftercare center because they don't like have enough resources, and mm-hmm. I don't need those books in third grade. But I didn't make the connection of like the golden spine is called golden books. It happened right now in this moment. I'm wondering if this like the book is sitting in my garage.
Or oh my god! If you have it, please bring it over so we can look at it.
I have so many books. I have so many old. Inappropriate books. Like I found this one book that was let's just call it Holocaust sensitive, and I found it in the elementary school I was working at last year, and I said something to the librarian about it, and she was like, that's disgusting, where'd you find this book? I said, in the teacher's lounge.
Wow.
Yeah, so I mean, like, just going back to the golden books, I truly wonder, like, I'll send a picture at least tomorrow if I do have it, but that's, and I've been dropping them in, like, the book boxes around my neighborhood because I'm just trying to get rid of them. And, like, figured, like, oh, children around the neighborhood would love these books. So.
Yeah, give them the Holocaust book.
No, not the Holocaust book. I already, like, I even told the librarian, like, I don't know if I should keep this. And then donate it to, like, a Holocaust resource center. Like,
oh, that's a good idea. Like,
the local colleges to put on display, like, what not to do if you become a writer. or if I should burn it. And I was like, I don't know.
Burn it.
Right?
But, yeah, but like, a library or something.
It was like a Madeline book too.
Wow. What?
Yeah. Like the Madeline series.
Weird.
Yeah.
Huh.
It was terrible. But again, the golden books. Like I'm really, really curious of whether.
Yeah. I'm going to have to look on Amazon for it.
If you guys want to know about some other anti-Semitic shit, all those Smurf things. Yeah. That's all fucking Nazi nonsense.
Wait. The Smurfs?
Yeah,
are you about to ruin the Smurfs for me?
Oh, fuck yes, I am. Look, you're singing like Nazi propaganda.
Oh my god!
Yeah.
This is like my whole other side of my life. Like, I'm super into Holocaust research. I like do this for fun. I'm looking at a whole stack of Holocaust books. Actually, it's really funny if you look. I got this book today.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah. So,
What is that? Oh, okay.
It's called Leap Into Darkness.
I saw that. Thank you for explaining. But what is the full context of what it's about? I know it's a Holocaust. I'm assuming it's a Holocaust.
I got this book on recommendation. Like, it was handed to me from my boyfriend's mom. It was about escaping. Oh, it was a young boy escaping Nazi Germany.
Okay.
And he was like almost 7 years old, and he was just crossing borders and trying to just like prevent being sent to Auschwitz. And so it was like his story. I don't know if it's a memoir or if it's historical fiction.
Okay. I understand that the Holocaust is very important, but on a more important note, can you explain the Smurfs to me?
Yes, please.
Okay.
I'm about to ruin my childhood.
Okay. Well, God, I haven't even thought about this in so fucking long.
Cliff's notes.
From what I understand, there's a whole bunch of weird stuff going on. Those comics, the creator, Herge, or whatever the fuck his name is. From what I understand, he has some complications, like people have talked about, like, since he died. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I think Gargamel is supposed to be, like, a Jewish stereotype. And I think part of the reason why Smurfette is the only woman and a blonde woman is because she's like a perfect Aryan woman, if you get what I'm saying.
Okay.
And Gargamel wants to eat the Smurfs, and I don't know if that's a full-on like stereotype of something like Jew. Maybe that's like a Jews eat babies thing or something. I don't know. I just always thought the Smurfs sucked like from the beginning. So I was just never. And then when I was like, oh, they're Nazis. No fucking wonder. Jesus. Like,
I guess I was too young to understand. And then by the time I was older, they were in my past. But I'm totally going to do a deep dive now.
Yeah, no, I just did. Like, these are fast. Rob, I want to agree. Just really quick from MotherJones.com. It says, Gargamel, the mean-spirited sorcerer and primary antagonist in the Smurfs universe, is driven by his desire for world domination and by his plot to throw the Smurfs into his magical harvesting concentration camps.
And what about, what about the cat?
Concentration camps.
Oof.
I've never heard about his concentration camp. He would catch him and put him in a cage.
How much fucking worse can the cat be?
Cage. I mean, it was a cage. I saw the cage.
Just an interpretation. Like,
it was an actual cage.
No, I know, but can you interpret it as something else?
I get you can interpret it as anything, but what about the cat? Was the cat cool? Asriel?
Okay, Asriel was a Nazi, but the cat wasn't. Cat was just like,
ruined Dr. Claw for me.
Oh, Asriel, which is the name of the angel of death from Hebrew tales.
Oh,
the
angel
of death. Oh, okay.
Wait till I tell Alex.
Okay. But I bet the cat was just like, you know what, man? I don't know what your like big thing going on here is, but you give me a place to sleep and milk, and I'm just going to roll with it. So as long as you're just not all up in my space, I guess whatever happens, happens. Probably what the cat is doing, at least.
Yeah, I mean, cats are too fucking cool for us. So that cat was probably like, God, I don't care as long as I'm fed.
By the way, you want to talk about one cool cat? I have a episode I'm going to be recording coming up in October on the two-season series, The Twisted Tales of Felix the Cat.
Stop.
Yeah.
Feel like I can't wait to listen.
Yeah. I'm excited for that because it's a genuinely good cartoon, and I didn't even respect it when I was younger for some reason. I just didn't want to watch it, but it's got all these Ren and Stimpy and Simpsons people on it. It seems incredible. I've been through like two or three episodes, and they're all a hell of a lot of fun, and they're weird and surreal in the way like those good 90s cartoons were.
Sounds so cool.
It was the most expensive thing like Phil Roman ever produced, and Phil Roman, forgive me, it's not Phil Roman, he nearly bankrupted his company putting it together, from what I understand. But it has the real feel of those like 20s, 30s, and like some of the stuff from the 50s, those cartoons that made Felix such a big name. Of course, a lot of people know him from the TV series they did around the 70s, I think.
Those are probably the reruns that I saw.
Yeah,
For me, Felix the Cat is in like the same category as Betty Boop. I know that they were before my time, but they were cartoons that came on at some point.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, you know, it wasn't my Looney Tunes or my Smurfs, my Nazi indoctrination cartoons, but, but it was definitely something that I remember watching, even if I don't remember the plot lines, if that makes sense.
Like the boomerang category. Like it was on the Boomerang channel. I'm like, you only played that when like nothing was on Cartoon Network.
But well, this is before Cartoon Network existed. We're going back to the Stone Age, yeah. Brittany. Come on.
Oh, I mean, if you're going to talk about the 90s, this is what I'm relating to. I just remember like Felix the Cat and like the Flintstones and the Jetsons and like things like that were on Boomerang.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Boomerang was the awesome channel.
Oh, yeah. No, it was. When I fully discovered it, I was like, oh, shit.
I used to love watching Top Cat on it.
You like Top Cat?
I see a theme here.
Well, I'm not saying it's me. I'm not trying to be mean. I just
No.
I just never understood like as a cartoon, it's on shaky ground, I think, because like the whole cartoon is just like Top Cat and there's like a cop cat and then there's his cat gang and they cause shenanigans.
Yeah.
And that's all I could really like think of. Like they're going like they're sort of like Heathcliff on a certain level where it's going after food or they're just trying to like steal cars, maybe. I don't know if that was a thing they had kids do, like watch on Saturday mornings.
But apparently.
It was one of those Hanna-Barbera series that had like one or like a season and a half, and it's insanely popular in like Spain or Brazil, somewhere around there. I can't tell you exactly where. Yeah, but it was so popular they made a direct-to-video CGI movie based around Top Cat.
Oh shit! I had no idea.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah, I didn't know.
Yeah, you should look that up. They really put the big bucks in that one.
I guess I was like a Hanna-Barbera kid. I mean, I know the Flintstones and the Jetsons were a little bit before my time, and even Tom and Jerry, and Top Cat. But like all of those, I used to love watching them on Boomerang.
Nothing to be Scooby-Doo. Ashamed of. I think the designs are really good, and as I get older, I like the designs of them. And as I was growing up, I think I liked all that stuff and the Warner stuff more than Disney because it just felt like more strange to me. Like Disney felt real and that was good and that was impressive, but all this other stuff just felt like it was different and I didn't mm-hmm. understand it. Like I didn't understand Yogi Bear for a long time as a child. Like he's smarter than the average bear, but he's never successful of getting a picnic basket that he actually eats from.
And
so, how much smarter than the actual bear is he? Occasionally, bears succeed in such endeavors. So, yeah. I just feel like it reflects poorly on his character writing.
I think your average bear just shows up and the people leave the picnic basket where it is. Success.
See, these are the questions I spent my years growing up instead of learning. Like I spent my years asking instead of learning about physics or geography or something goddamn useful in this world.
But you know what? Like the cartoons were on. I mean, even before Boomerang, cartoons were way more accessible than Disney because for me, Disney represented movies. You know, And then they had I forgot the term for it.
The Disney Saturday morning, is that what you want?
No.
Oh, okay.
But the movies, they would only come out and be available for purchase years.
They had the theatrical re-releases is what you're trying to say.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you could have the video of them or you could see them in the theater, but as far as television, it was For me, at least, like for my upbringing, it was Looney Tunes and Hanna-Barbera stuff. That's what was on because it was on TV. I didn't have to pop a movie in the VCR. I didn't have to worry about going to the theater. And, you know, my parents weren't far from wealthy growing up, so buying us movies wasn't really a thing. They taped. I can't even tell you, you know, they just taped. We were fortunate enough to have a VCR, but they taped what was on. So if it came on TV, they recorded it and we got it. If not, then we really didn't have it. So the cartoon shows were more so what we were able to watch than the movies. Yeah. So Disney was almost like a treat, if that makes sense.
It was a whole aspect of this accessibility. And then going back to like when I was a kid, I feel like it was really similar. I remember whatever TV provider we had, you had to pay like a package to get Disney.
Disney was extra.
And I grew up the same way as you. So like we couldn't afford Disney. So I don't remember watching Disney until I was about like 10 or 11. And I didn't make that connection. I had some VHSs of like old princesses, but like never made a Disney connection at all. Still can't today. So like I really heavily, and Nickelodeon really wasn't like that big. And if it was too adult for how old I was. So my parents kind of like monitored that, and I was left for a lot of like Cartoon Network, which
for a long time, like we didn't even have cable. And then I remember going to my grandmother's house and she had cable, and one of my favorite shows was You Can't Do That on Television. I don't even know if you remember that.
Oh, I remember.
You remember that show?
I remember You Can't Do That.
I would just wait for them to say water or I don't know. And I was like, yes, because if you said water, you would get dumped with water.
Right.
And if you said, I don't know, you would get slimed. It was like a little primitive skit show, I guess, like you would call it. But it was my favorite. It was like everything back then.
Nickelodeon, they kept the slime up for many a year. I remember growing up seeing the slime just oozing down and whatever the hell they wanted it to.
And Double Dare.
Double Dare 2000.
Yeah, I remember the Double Dare 2000. That was
I wanted to be on that show so bad. I wanted to meet Mark Summers. I was like, I remember trying to make my family do obstacles in the backyard and they're like, no.
Stop.
Please.
Yeah, I was probably an intolerable child because I liked all the loud, annoying cartoons. You know, the louder and more annoying and harder to look at it was, I was just hooked. Anything that made me, anything that repelled people away from me and like was just like nothing I had ever seen, you know, and this like span from the Warner stuff. Hanna-Barbera has some of that in there, but it's mostly like their 90s output, like the stuff like Dexter's Laboratory and things of that nature. Johnny Bravo was a show I used to like a lot, which I don't know if I like that thing at all anymore. I haven't seen it in so many years.
A little problematic now.
Oh, yeah. But believe you and me, I was doing the monkey with him. You know, I was not afraid.
All were.
Yeah, it was a big show. That was a show that brought in old Seth MacFarlane, helped bring him into the Cartoon Network.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he worked on that with the creator, and that him and that creator were big fans. And he had a short on a... like Cartoon Planet or What a Cartoon, one of those random original shorts cartoon programs they had on Cartoon Network. There was like three or four of them, probably all done by Fred Rader. And he had a short on there that kind of like presages Family Guy and has some of the Family Guy like hallmarks, so you can look that up. That's a lot of fun.
Oh, wow.
We've had so much fun reminiscing. We should get back to Gabriel.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
We're bad at tangents.
Loud cartoons that repulse people. Let's talk about Gabriel again.
Back to kitty trafficking.
Back to the kitty trafficking. Speaking of which, Maurice completes his grooming process by having all the famous painters of Paris paint her portrait, and they do it on all their signature styles, as we mentioned earlier.
It's such an amazing scene.
Yeah, it's one of the great hallmarks of the film. Like, it's just a beautiful, beautiful part of the film. They find clever ways to integrate her into the paintings too. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. How'd you feel about it, Brittany?
I was just shocked when that part of the scene came up. But when this scene in the movie came up, I was just like, wait, I'm getting a lesson too?
So serious.
Yeah, no, this one didn't fly. I mean, like, as a kid, I could see it flying over my head. But as the full-fledged adult, I was just like, oh, shit, let's go, art history. And I really did love the way that she was incorporated in all those different styles of painting. I love the pointillism one. I just thought that was adorable. And just, yeah, like, again, the incorporation, it was just wild, unexpected. And I don't know, it was just wild and unexpected. I love it in the movie, though.
Yeah, and not just does he show you how they paint and incorporate her into a painting in that artist style, but he even gives a history of that person. And I was just like, that's very cool. Like, I really wish that I had not glossed over that as a kid.
Yeah, this is when Maurice takes her out into the city on the buggy, and there's this whole exchange about kissing, and she's so naive, she doesn't even know what kissing is. But I think really this is more of a code word for the adults about fucking in buggies. Like, they have these very pointed jokes. Like, there's one joke about how Maurice explains that all these people in buggies are sitting around kissing, like, out from the turn of the century. And this is at a time when this was a popular thing for young people to do, because it was one of the first times in history when young people could get out and get away from their parents through these things like buggies and early cars. And I thought it was a real interesting historical point to make. She's very surprised at the idea that all these people that are just randomly sitting in buggies in the park might be making out. And he's like, if you took all the buggies, you know, if you took out all the people who made out in buggies in Paris or something like that, then you'd have half the buggies gone in Paris or something like that. I can't remember the exact phrase, and I'm so sorry I'm butchering that.
No, you almost got it right. I didn't write it down, but I remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
You got the gist of it.
Yeah, I got the gist of it. Anyways, what he's saying is, you know, you take out all the people who are fucking in Paris, you're going to have half the people with buggies just straight gone from the city. And he's probably not wrong.
No.
After he convinces her to kiss him so he can kind of show her how it is, and she plays it off like it's no big deal, he has talked her into staying, and she's been made over. They go back, and that's when he introduces her to the concept that she is going to be an American mail order bride. And that's when we get the infamous get in the buggies. It's like, what is it, like a box? Like, it's just a straight box. Is that how they refer to it?
Yeah.
Oh, man. So it's just like a straight get in the box. Like, that's what he says. Like, oh, man. It's
something like that.
Yeah, it's cruel. Oh, we forgot about the money cat scene, didn't we? I'm so sorry. The money cat scene is one of the highlights of this movie. Maybe I'm mistaken for how the hell it, like, works. Oh, okay. The money cat scene comes in, like, after he's dropped her off at the Madame for training for a minute. And then they go into the money cat scene. And that's all about how he's going to sell her off to this, like, fat, rich American. And later on, when she finds out about it, that's when we get the line that she doesn't want to, like, go with this fat, like, ugly person. And I thought, like, wow, that's a really intense line. Like, I totally get that you don't want to be with this person, but is that the thing you're gonna glom onto as a character? Like, it felt really raw to me. But hey, you know, I don't blame her either. She doesn't want to be with that person whatsoever, and she can have whatever the hell reason she wants for not being with that person. You know what I mean?
Well, especially since she's not even really given a choice.
Right, right. Like, this is completely non-consensual, you know? Like, she's screaming in horror. I thought, like, maybe that's just, like, an internal bias kind of popping up in a moment of horror, so I didn't hold her against her. But I don't think a film, even later than that, would quite go into that level of intensity for a kid's film. You know what I'm saying? I found it interesting. Like, I found it really interesting. After after all this business with the okay, we forgot. We damn it. This
post.
Plot,
it's always post.
Yeah. This plot is very jumbled in a certain manner. When after I think it's after the Money Cat song, we see what happens to Jean-Tom and Robespierre, and they are they are duped into going like on a giant like fishing expedition or a hunting. It's probably a hunting expedition, and they're like they're a ship cat, as it's referred to. And Maurice is also behind this. He gets them drunk. That's what leads to the never-ending bubble scene.
Okay, Musetta's dropped back off at the madam's place.
Yeah,
and Jean-Tom and Robespierre are in Paris looking for her. They're basically on the verge of giving up.
Yeah,
but right as they're about to, Jean-Tom notices the word feline on the door. And it struck a chord for him.
Hello?
No, she cut out.
Whichever. Did I cut out again?
Yeah, we heard struck a chord.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Yeah, so Jean-Tom bangs on the door. But before anybody can answer, Robespierre gets dragged into the sewer. The sewer, thank you.
Yeah.
By one of the little cats. Maybe Armand. That's the only one that we ever learn his name. Don't that remind you of my cats? Because like all you ever see is the eyes.
Back and they run past.
Yeah.
Hey, those cats had a great design and they worked really well with this movie. I had a fun time with them.
It's so funny because I can't even tell you how many times when I look at one of my cats, Elvis, I'm like, all right, Money Cat, because he just has that face about him, doesn't he? Brittany, you know.
He has like the markings too.
Yes.
And so, wow, he really is ever... Money Cat and your two other cats. And your two other cats are like the little minion cats. Wow. I think Lisa cut out again.
Sorry. What'd you say?
I said that Elvis really is like the Money Cat and the other two. Like Luke and Leia are really like.
Yeah.
His little minions. Yeah.
And he is a little fucking asshole too. So, you know.
As soon as Robespierre gets pulled into the sewer, like that's when.
Yeah, he goes right after him.
Yeah. Like Musette then opens up the door and looks around because we had Jean-Tom like knocking on the door. And so they end up in the sewer. They get out of the sewer. And that's when the letter's being mailed about how Musette is going to be sent over.
Yeah. And that's how Maurice finds him.
Mm-hmm. That's when a mouse crawls out of the sewer and all of a sudden, like, the sewer cap starts rattling. And that's when Jean-Tom, like, just dashes after it, like we see in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
And so that's when those characters are introduced.
Right. And that's what draws his attention. And he flips through his Rolodex in his head and is like, oh. I know how I can make money off of this cat.
Yeah. He's conniving, that is for sure. I think they do a lot of good character work with just showing how conniving he is. Like, I like the character on that level, you know? Like, I thought that was well drawn out for being a villain in a cartoon movie. Yep, and after that, that's when the bubble song happens, and then they wake up on a ship going to Alaska with a bunch of hunters, and they end up going to Alaska. After we see that happen, after they're on the ship, we cut back to Musette and Maurice, and that's when Maurice really explains the box thing, and that's when we see Musette run out and she's on the streets of Paris for like 5 or 6 months, if I remember the heading saying. And
yeah, it was a while.
Yeah.
It was 6 months because that's how long it took for Maurice's tail to heal.
And like Jean-Tom's like expedition, he came back from that and he had struck gold accidentally while trying to catch a mouse. And that was really, like, they had done the eye copter thing before, but that looked really like the eye scope thing, but that part of the movie looked like it had a little bit more, I don't know, devotion to it or something. I don't know, it hit harder that time than it did the first time. I really liked it. Yeah, him and Robespierre, like, they struck a whole ton of gold, too. It was like he went into the side of a mountain, and it was just like gold upon gold falling out. Crazy nuggets, like, the amount of nuggets you wouldn't believe.
I wish my cats were that useful.
Yeah, all cats should be that useful, for sure.
Well, the one good thing you could say about Meow Reese, right, is that he may be a trafficker, but he's equal opportunity. So, male cats, female cats, he's got a buyer for anything.
Yeah.
It's important to be, fair.
Once Maurice finally heals up, he finally, like, gets a hold of Musette, and he's going to ship her off. He ends up giving a blank check. Well, it's not a blank check precisely. He uses invisible ink to, I guess the correct term is disappearing ink, because it's there for a minute and then it disappears. And he uses that to screw over his sister, the madame. She is very upset about this. And when she comes across John Tom looking for her, she immediately gives him up, like, oh, they went to go do this. You need to go after them. And if you see them, give them my best regards and like physical blessing or something like that. I can't remember the exact phrasing, but it was.
And turn him inside out or something.
Turn him inside out. Yeah.
But I have a little gripe.
Okay.
So maybe I misunderstood, because again, you know, when Musette is running away from them and they're going all over the city, up, down, everywhere to look for her, you see that she's cowering inside. So at the same time, the cats are in Alaska, they struck gold, and then they came back. I don't remember the exact amount of time that it was before they got back, because this is a ship. I don't even know which route a ship would take from Paris to Alaska, but that's besides the point.
Right.
Either way, a long amount of time has passed, but then you see her still cowering and sitting inside of that statue. And I'm like, didn't she eat? What is she, my weirdo fucking neighbors? Like, what was she doing that whole time?
Scraping
for weeks,
by.
Months.
Scraping by, just narrowly missing those crazy cats.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Continuity, sorry.
It's okay. Like, as a montage, it kind of plays badly, doesn't it? Because it doesn't really show her, like, getting food or anything like that. Yeah, I agree. They should have done a little more in the montage to kind of show the desperation of the whole thing. Because it's basically a giant chase between her and the other cats.
And in all that time, she could have gotten anywhere else.
Yeah. I agree.
That would have been like a lot for her character arc, to show that growth of her surviving.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's like slightly conveyed, but it isn't done the way it should be.
And so finally, she's on this bridge and she just lets out like a puff. And then all of a sudden she turns and she sees Maurice. Like, they find her, right?
Yeah. Like, Maurice finds her, and that's when like Jean Tom comes across her. And I think he ends up taking out Maurice with like his, you know, his mouse focus. I'm sorry if I'm a little vague on the.
No, so she, Maurice finds her. I forgot where, but he finds her, and then gets her in the basket. And I can't remember how.
Oh, okay.
Because she jumps off the bridge.
Oh, right. And they catch her. You're right. Yeah.
They put her in the box, because the next scene, like, you could see like just her eyes, like it's dark in the box.
In the basket. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's when she
writes, like, in cursive,
something on the floor with her nail through the box. And she engraves a message for if Chantal, like,
that they're taking her to the train. But you can get your whole paw through that box and write with your claw, but you can't get out of the box. What the fuck? Yeah. If cats can do anything, they can get out of a box. I don't know. I guess it's like I said, I'm looking at this with like adult eyes, and it's talking cartoon cats.
yeah. How much logic can you put into something of such a thing? But anyways, like Maurice had that whole time too, where he had to like heal up as well from getting injured by the bulldog. So I don't think he's quiet on his game, but they catch up with him and Jean-Tom and Robespierre catch up with Maurice and Musette. Mm-hmm. Now these names are driving me crazy. I'm so sorry. on the train as they're going away, and there's like this big fight scene between Maurice and Jean-Tom, and the three heroes defeat Maurice, and they take Maurice and put him in the crate that was intended for Musette. And that's a really great part of the movie where they're like, we're just going to ship you off to this old fat dude that was going to like take advantage of our friends, see how you like it. Yeah. That made me feel really good.
It was such a random, the guy's name was Mr.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I'm missing something, but I couldn't grasp any connection between the name and joke or anything.
Well, I think that's a pun on what he is to the character of Musette. He is nothing.
Okay.
He is something that she would blow off. I don't want to be with that man.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. And the address was, I forgot the numbers, but Sandbox Lane. And it was like Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. It's Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I know that.
It's just so random.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Dorothy and Chuck Jones have family in Pittsburgh. You never know.
That's a good point.
Getting that call out for him, I guess. Yep, and after that, the film concludes with Musette, Wanton, and Robespierre enjoying the high life in Paris.
And because they're rich cats now.
Yeah.
Gold.
Yeah, from all the gold. It's a beautiful thing. Beautiful thing. I think the film ends just fine. I think the end had some pretty good animation for what it was. There's only a couple of times I felt where the animation kind of let me down. The scene where they're walking along the train platform, along the train track, just when they get out from like hanging onto the railroad track and they're walking along it, he's walking along it as if it's just the regular road. But we've seen how far away the tracks are from each other. So they would have to be taking like crazy long steps to be able to go like track to track, and they're just walking on it like it's grass or something, just leisurely strolling across these train tracks that we have explicitly seen as being like so far apart from each other, like they wouldn't be able to work. It doesn't function at all.
Right.
I think maybe that was the one part of the movie where they were just like, ah, fuck it, we can do it. It'll be fine.
And why was there only one? What happens when the train comes from the other direction?
Yeah, we didn't see any of that stuff happening.
Where's that track?
City, please.
Yeah. I thank you so much for coming on here and doing this with us, both of you.
Oh, this is so much fun. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, we pretty much got to the end of our film. Anything else you want to say, please say it now. We can go for however long, much longer you want, for whatever you need to say.
I just want to say thank you again for inviting me back, because I know I can be a little bit of a train wreck and I go off on tangents, but this was fun. And to have the opportunity to break down this movie is surreal. That's all I can say. It's just so surreal. but I'm you. Having a good time.
I got you.
And I just want to reiterate the thanks for this opportunity to have, well, this is Lisa's second time, but this is my first time being on your podcast. Thank you so much for your invitation and your good vibes and just everything. It was really funny. And it was really interesting watching this movie. Lisa mentioned it a couple weeks, 2 weeks ago, maybe, or a week ago. I was like, gay puree, what the fuck is that? I'm like, what is she getting me into? Also, just a quick note.
Something you should always ask yourself when I'm involved.
Oh, she's cowering. What is gay puree?
We see the no, what is Lisa getting me into?
Cowering yeah, right? inside of a statue.
So wouldn't you miss your cats her. If they just like
at the same left? Time, this is when like, the other cats about, like, are on the boat to Alaska. Like, I mean, I might not miss picking
but
up
then you see every day, but yeah.
No, but you know every what I mean? Like, wasn't she owned by like the woman who was from Paris?
They strike
every gold. Day.
Oh my God, every day. Brittany knows. Every fucking day. This we have three cats. One is Elvis, who's like my version of Meow Reese, and then the other two are siblings. And every day they vomit, every single day.
They're doing that on purpose.
Then. I think so.
Yeah, they're doing that on purpose. Yeah.
But I don't know. I might be like, you know what? Farewell. Have a good life. I'm going to enjoy all those hours of not having to pick up vomit or step in it slip on it and wash it and
totally.
Whatever.
Totally. I agree. I'm so thankful to have you on. This was such a interesting film to go
I'm
over.
Glad you enjoyed it. Honestly, yeah. It's, you know, it's weird because here I am mentioning a film that I basically grew up with watching. And so it has that special place for me of a beloved childhood film. Not that I watch it so much as an adult, but and to then have you want to discuss it, it's cool. Yeah, it's really cool. So I appreciate that.
Hey, I'm so happy to have you here. I'm so sorry we had to get rid of the Fritz the Cat episode. Our friend, our mutual friend Chuck is no longer in the podcasting game.
Listen, it's all good. Chuck was awesome. And, you know, I wish him well. But I understand. And, you know, no hard feelings ever. You got to do what you got to do.
Hey, yeah. And I also have like more complicated feelings about Mr. Bakshi after finding out some stuff about him. I just don't feel like I feel like I wouldn't have made the same choices with my podcast. But that's okay now. I don't feel like I did those episodes in the wrong spirit. I feel like I tackled with those things while I wanted to, and I said the things I wanted to say about how I felt. You know, like I don't feel bad about the episode I did. I just feel bad that Mr. Bakshi can't seem to keep his hands to himself in some instances throughout his career. And
is this like a hashtag Me Too situation?
I don't know if it really fucking matters if I do it for this 80-year-old man, but it's a little frustrating to me as a fan when he's like put up this whole front as being the, you know, jolly big rough-natured cartoon guy. It just, I don't know. I think there's a little more to that guy than he's ever let the public want to know or care, you know, cares to let his fans in on. And I think some of his movies are way too sentimental about some elements of society that he shouldn't be sentimental about, and have been unhealthy for him and unhealthy for a lot of people throughout the years.
I mean, I think I've only seen the Fritz the Cat. I don't think I've ever seen anything else done by him, at least to my knowledge, but I could definitely see based on that movie how if that was what was going on in his head, how he could be a problematic person.
Yeah,
I don't know
if
I'm in the zone, but I could see it.
Yeah, you know, I always I'm just not taking him with so much of a grain of salt anymore, mm-hmm. if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with enjoying a movie or a TV show, in my opinion, as long as you're not idolizing the people that make them, because they're human too. I really just want my podcast to be a forum for, like, reasonable discussion, you know, and how I, like, being able to discuss how I feel about the world and getting it out there,
yeah.
getting opinions about it. I'm so glad you came in and did that episode with us.
But you know, and I know that you took the episode down, but I remember thinking how problematic that movie was, looking at it through the eyes of today. But I stand behind my thoughts in that we can learn from our past.
Yeah.
And we can learn from the movies and the art and the culture that was before us. And it doesn't have to be something that is necessarily idolized or adhered to today, but I don't think that it necessarily has to be banished, because it was a reflection of maybe not just the artist, but of the time that it was put forth.
Yeah,
and I think that's important to keep in mind, because the saying that if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it, or something like that. I might not have the words right.
Well, yeah,
and I believe it. I believe in it.
Yeah, you know, and that's a thing too. I feel like, you know, understanding that this guy has an extreme history of being, like, angry and nonsensical and irrational mm-hmm. with people. Like, a lot of the stories behind Cool World that I've heard from him seem illegitimate now that I've gotten access to some of the materials that I've been able to get, you know, and that's part of that's because I hadn't had the money to get those materials too, you know. I've been trying to do just different things and trying to survive on my own. Like, I can only put so much into my own personal research all the time because I have to deal with bills and,
of course,
what everybody deals with in this hell of an economy we live in. But moving on, I once again, I want to thank you so much. I thought this was a really fascinating film to talk about. I did not think we'd get 2 hours out of this thing. I really was not planning on 2 hours. I'm so sorry if I took up too much of your night, ladies. Yeah, don't worry.
It could be any worse than the last time we recorded. I don't remember what platform you used, but it wouldn't work for my computer, so I had to use my phone, and then my phone died. And then I used my iPad, and then we had a thunderstorm and the power went out, so I lost internet. It was like everything that could go wrong went wrong.
Yeah, it took us like 4 hours that thing.
I felt so bad. I'm so sorry still.
it's perfectly okay. Don't worry about it at all. Brittany,
it was horrible.
Thank you for joining us. I'm so glad you were capable of coming on. If either one of you have any projects outside the Sass and Sips, feel free to promote them now.
So outside Sass and Sips, I'm beginning a new career. I'm supplying my own classroom with my savings.
The most noblest of careers.
Yeah, so I am a teacher. This is my first year teaching. I had a change in career, so I went back to school, just graduated in May. Here I am going to a first-time classroom, district I do not know, and a town I'm not from, and it's just a lot. And so I want to say, well, actually, after talking to my accountant, I can only write off $250 of what I bought, which I would say is about only a fourth of what I've supplied for my classroom.
Jeez. Yeah.
And so with that, I do have an Amazon wish list of some essential items I still do need for my classroom.
Still,
so yeah. that could be thrown there. Lisa, you have the link.
Yeah. Yeah, I can send that to you if you'd like.
Yeah, you're welcome to. I have massive, like, criticisms I can make of the public teaching institutions, but at the end of the day, I don't want teachers to have to spend so much money to do that crap especially when they have to like form these unions just to get basic stuff, you know, like sick days and things like that. And then they have to spend so much money that they can't even recoup all of like that. That's nonsense. Thank you for bringing that to my podcast. You're welcome to promote that on my podcast anytime you need to.
Thank you so much. I really do appreciate that. It's been a journey this summer going to like estate sales. I was just at a sale where there was like a 4-foot Victorian doll hanging in front of the door. And I was like, I have to go in. There are cheap items in here. And, you know, doing that whole thing to supply my classroom on a very limited budget, which I definitely went over. So, you know.
Yeah. In the Fritz the Cat episode we recorded, we kind of got into a discussion about the current state of teaching. And part of that movie is kind of how if you don't understand the past, then you're doomed to repeat it. Fritz is a sped out, you know, loser who ends up burning his school books and then hanging out with Nazis by the end of the film and almost dying in an explosion that he gets roped into from them.
It's one fucking crazy movie. Seriously.
Yeah it's wild. But,
I mean,
but yeah, like this is the
it's
kind
worth
of thing,
the watch.
This is the kind of thing. This is the kind of thing that happens when our kids don't have education on any means as reasonable, you know, that is easily available, when teachers can't easily supply their classrooms. Like, people get discouraged in the basic educational systems to where they just make irrational decisions because they can't get access to education, or they can't get access to education that is helpful to them in a way that they might need it to be.
I was just gonna say it sucks because like something like education is just so fundamental, and it sucks when the classroom being supplied properly is dependent on the actual teacher's wallet.
I'm sorry you have to deal with that. Like, the idea that you can't deduct everything is a complete working class like attack. Like, it's saying that you don't deserve to be able to deduct everything because you're a teacher. You don't give back to society with your own money fully, or something like that. Like, that's what it's implying, even though you are. You're giving back to society by doing that. Like,
there's so much guilt already forming, and I haven't even started the position, and that's wild. I mean, I'm on a 10-month contract, and the majority of teachers are on 10-month contract, which means that you're not paid during the summer. And so to lose money, not even gain money during the summer for a job that I'm not currently working, it's just it's crazy. Yeah. But with education, thankfully, like a positive that has come out of COVID and the pandemic, if we want to find a positive, is the ability to have accessibility to so many online resources that are actually like worthy and knowledgeable. But that doesn't mean that because your child has access to those, that that's not a full education. And so just to instill that, whether it's public, private, or religious, like putting your child in school is so, so important. There's a big wave right now of parents pulling their students out of school, or their children out of school, and enrollment's dropping like rapidly.
Yeah.
And parents are educating from home with services by themselves. And that is a whole nother field, but keeping our kids in school with teachers in an atmosphere where it's the only focus is safety and education, I think, is just so important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm biased. So, I mean, I want a job. So,
No.
Because it's school, I can work.
You're not biased at all. You're perfectly reasonable. I do not believe in the communist witch hunting that is happening towards the educational system. People are completely overblowing how, like, they're just overblowing like basic shit. Like, I'm sorry, some kids have gotten abused by people who had ill intentions. That doesn't mean you can demonize whole groups of people over it. Like, I don't like any of this MAGA nonsense on my podcast. I don't want to support anyone who supports it. They are some of the people that are specifically like targeting the institutions of learning that we actually need in this country to be able to think rationally. But feel free to say such a thing on any podcast I host, Brittany. You're always welcome.
Thank you so much. I agree with taking the politics out of education, but definitely we got to get back to the basics on education, just educating your children's what matters, period.
Well, maybe you can start taking the politics out of education when other people start taking the politics out of education. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I'm Robbie Sherman. This has been Conversations with Robbie Sherman. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you.